Hey guys, and welcome to the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report, presented by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. The first podcast to bring you the local fishing report for Alabama's lakes and rivers, whether it's good, bad, or ugly. I'm your host, Nick Williams, and this week's show is brought to you by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. Are you frustrated by your typical hunting and fishing magazines? Are you tired of reading content meant for guys up north or in the Midwest? Don't get left behind following the guidance of guys who don't hunt and fish in your home state. Pick up a Great Days Outdoors magazine subscription and become a better Southern outdoorsman. Great Days Outdoors magazine can be found at your local Books A Million, Tractor Supply Company, Rural King, or you can save and buy online at greatdaysoutdoors.com. Hey folks, got a quick announcement. AFTCO has a new promotion for all Great Days Outdoors Podcast Network listeners. They are now offering a camo sunglasses cleaner cloth with any purchase of AFTCO products. We've become very fond of their hooded sun protection shirts as well as their Seiko fluorocarbon here at Great Days Outdoors. All that you have to do to get your coupon code is text ALFFR to 779-345-2918. Again, just text ALFFR, that's Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report, to 779-345-2918. Subscribe to our email list and we'll send you the promo code via email. Alrighty guys, welcome back to another week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report. I'm sitting here high and dry on the river, hoping I don't get swept away by these afternoon showers that are popping up and drowning everybody. Things are looking good in the state. Spring is progressing. It's getting warmer, turning into summer over the course of the weekend. Me and my wife got away on Mother's Day, went to go do a little creek fishing, kind of beat the heat. And we're here today to talk with somebody else who does some creek fishing down in southeast Alabama. We got Taylor Horror reporting in. Taylor, what you been up to?
Hey, Nick. Yeah, I've been doing pretty good. Like you said, it's getting warmer down here in the southern part of the state. Wiregrass, we've been getting close to the 90s for the past 2 or 3 weeks and not a whole lot of rain. So the water's been clearer than it usually is. So it's been good to get out and do some fishing and make it a combo like creek swimming trip as well. So yeah, everything's going good. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. No, I enjoy it. We don't get a lot of information from the Wiregrass region. I did some fishing trips on it last year, and it's got a lot of doesn't have much in the way of big reservoirs outside of, I guess, Eufaula. But there's some really interesting fisheries there. So what have you been having some success up in the little skinny water?
Yeah, I'll usually I think I might have touched on it last time, but I usually fish stuff where if you're like in a canoe or a paddleboard in the middle of the channel, you can hit either bank pretty easily. So yeah, fishing some skinny stuff and smaller rivers or bigger creeks is kind of my niche. What I've been really hitting a lot lately is the East Fork of the Chocktehatchee, which is kind of just north of Dothan, Alabama. I live in Headland, so it's like a 15-20 minute drive for me to get to the East Fork, the Chocktehatchee. And I'll go out there on a canoe or a paddleboard and just like scout on my Onyx or Google Maps before I go out and just look for some shoals or something that looks like an interesting feature where I think fish might be.
Anything in particular you've been throwing at them that's been doing the trick?
Yeah, so lately the water's been pretty low here. So I'll get down underneath or even in a shoal and I'll throw a spinner bait. I mostly fish like ultralight gear, so it'll just be like maybe a 1/8 or a 1/16 of an ounce spinner bait, or even like a beetle spin. And I'll get right below the shoal and kind of cast it up at about a 45 degree angle and just work it real slow. And that spinner blade will allow you to keep it in the strike zone, keep it off the bottom from being in that current, and kind of just slow the bait down so it's not sweeping through that swifter water. And a lot of times the fish will be like down kind of in a refuge from the current, like behind a rock or something. And it's warming up here, so they're looking up. And if you can get something to go over them that they have a chance to hit, they'll pretty reliably hit it. As far as patterns or colors, what I'll kind of try to do right now is imitate like a redbreast or some type of brim with like some orange showing, as well as like some chartreuse and green. just really anything to get their attention that you can keep it in front of their face long enough for them to hit it. They'll pretty reliably hit it. Mostly fishing spotted bass or Choctaw bass down here. So they kind of act like a smallmouth or other, like more of a bass that likes to hang out in the current. So if you can get anything in that current and get it by their face long enough for them to hit it, they'll usually take it. So that's kind of what I've been focusing on as far as them. And then brim, we got shadow bass, redbreast, bluegill. I'll throw usually like a real small beetle spin or even just a crappie jig, and I'll just be in a little bit slower water just around current, around structure, down logs or like cypress knees or roots sticking out of the bank. And they're aggressive too. Not a lot of people are fishing on the Chattahoochee or these creeks around here. They'll mostly go up to Eufaula and stuff. So a lot of these fish will take anything you put in front of them.
Yeah, that was my experience this past weekend getting in a little river that nobody's ever heard of, and you're not catching huge fish, and I wouldn't say you're just hammering catching lots of fish, but man, like the ones that you do catch, they're not particularly finicky. You know, if you get on them, they're eager to play ball. Like I think I may be about the only person that they've ever seen chuck a lure at them, which is fun in a different way. You know.
Yeah. It's good down here, but I'd love to see more people out there on the rivers down here too. I think a lot of people just don't know that that we have anything besides swampy stuff, but there's a lot of beautiful rivers and creeks down here that have like sandy bottoms or kind of like rocky gravelly bottoms, so it's not all swamps and gators and snakes. So
for sure,
I've been having a good time.
I think something that keeps people out of it, like where I was fishing this past weekend, you know, there's a big, with Alabama, we got so many big reservoirs and bass fishing got to be such a big thing and bass boats. And I feel like in this part of the world, we have a big boat culture, you know, and people who fish, they want to go. And what they grew up doing was either, you know, maybe a little bit of bank fishing, but a lot of guys, you know, they want somewhere where they can back a boat in and run up and down the river in these places that you're talking about. And where I've been doing a little bit of fishing here in the backwaters, like it's canoe water, you know, and in a lot of places you're dragging that canoe over some, like you said, some shoals and up around deadfalls and stuff like that. And it's just a very different type of fishing. If you're used to the big reservoirs or the big rivers that we have so many of, the skinny water thing, I think a lot of people, like you said, they either overlook it, don't know it's there, or they drive over it, but, you know, they look at this little bitty skinny thing of water and they're like, well, I don't know, you know, how I'd get a boat in that or how I'd go about fishing it. And something I've done to get in them, you got to either canoe them or I've played with some paddle boards in the past. And I think we talked a little bit about that off air last time. Paddle boards are a really good way to get up in there and do that, but they definitely present some fishing challenges, especially if you're like me. And you're starting to get a little bit of that dad bod, and you were never particularly, I was never any type of gymnast or athlete, even when I was young. So do you do a lot of that? Do you do a lot of paddling, specifically the paddleboard thing?
Yeah. So really my vessel of choice, now is an inflatable paddleboard. That way you don't have to throw like a canoe or kayak up on top of the car or, bring a trailer with you. Cause a lot of times you're just pulling off on the side of the road or, you know, just going down a little access road under a bridge, and it'd be kind of a headache to even try to get a trailer down there. So I've got a paddle board that you can just throw in the trunk, fold it up. And, when you get to wherever you're going to fish, you just blow it up. It takes 5-10 minutes. So, yeah, that works pretty good for me. And then, like you've probably seen before, I take my dog out sometimes and he's getting big enough where he'll knock me off the paddleboard. So if I'm going to take him and my wife might come, I'll take the canoe and we'll do a little leisurely float. But if I'm going out by myself, I'll take the paddleboard. If you've never paddleboarded or you don't feel comfortable like standing up trying to paddle it, what I usually do is take like a cooler and I'll just ratchet strap it down or use like a bungee cord and put that on there. Or I'm sure you could probably find like a little chair, like lawn chair or something at Academy that's made specifically for that. And you could strap it down and basically use it like a kayak, but it's inflatable. So it's a lot easier to to manage getting it to and from, and just getting it down to the water and back up to your car. So I'll do that. And really what I'll usually do, like I said, I'll look on Onyx and look for something that I want to try to hit. And I'll usually try to paddle upstream and then fish, and then I'll fish my way back down, because it's never fun if you get a you know, one of those South Alabama thunderstorms that just pop up out of nowhere, and you're a mile downstream and you have to try to get back upstream real quick. So I'll go upstream, hit a shoal, fish for a few hours, drink a beer or two on a little sandbar, and then float on back down the river.
It's definitely nice to float back downstream at the end. Is a really good palate cleanser. I do a lot of that type thing. And
yeah,
I've, like you said, the inflatable paddle boards, man, I was really slow to get on that trend. I used to work at an outdoor store, and I remember the first year we had them in, and I was like, man, those things are goofy. And then I ended up, Boat sent me one, and I rather begrudgingly fished out of it the first time, but you get used to it. Like, the one that I got now is 25 pounds, and it's a lot easier to haul 25 pounds up and down a riprap bank than it is to haul a 70-pound canoe. It's a lot different.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
When you,
oh, yeah.
When you get to them deep spots, you know, you can – mine, you can kind of pull it behind you as you go if you're wade fishing, and then you get to them places where, you know, you get like a little neck-deep hole or something, you just kind of coast over it. And I fish from mine a little bit. It can be a little tricky. Watching me fly fish from a stand-up paddle board is definitely something else. I've caught the attention of a few locals out there swimming, wondering what in the world I was doing. But I've had a lot of luck just using it to get around. And if you find a place you want to fish, just get out and wade. And, you know, you got a dry spot to set your stuff. And they're handy. Like, once you start using one, it's the ticket. If that's what you got is a bunch of skinny water. And then, like you said, like I tend to inflate mine at the house and rooftop it just because I can. But you know, you can fit the little inflatables. You can fit them in a Honda Civic. Back when I lived in an apartment complex, like, that was the type of thing that you could stow under the bed or in a closet and not have to worry about having that boat trailer. So they're definitely I think it's a great tool for somebody who's looking to get into fishing, who doesn't have the budget or the room for, you know, the traditional bass boat. They're definitely functional.
Oh yeah, you could get into one for like $150, and they're as durable as can be. I don't ever have any concerns like, oh, this thing's gonna pop or not last for a while. There's actually a dude that on YouTube, his name's Trip Smith. He's from Dothan as well, and he doesn't fish, but he uses that to go on like adventures and stuff. I think he's gone on like 3-day overnight trips, going like 50 miles on an inflatable paddleboard. And I watch him to try to get ideas on how to access, like, he uses Gnus and paddleboards and all kinds of stuff. And then he also just like goes on these big adventures down a lot of these rivers, and it gives me ideas on where I can fish. I like see him on the Pea River, the Kinnick, and I'm like, oh shoot, that looks like a good fishing spot. And then I'll figure out where he was and go fish there. So yeah, if you don't already have a boat, or if you've been going over bridges that look like they could be fishy, but you don't know how you're going to access it, inflatable paddleboard is the ticket for sure.
Yeah, they're definitely too. Like, I've used them a little bit to get into some of the little urban fisheries. You know, you get those little ponds and stuff like that that can be a bit of a pain to fish from the bank if they're not maintained super well. You can get out of that knee-high grass and cashed up along the shore, get to some better stuff. You were talking earlier, we talked off air, you just mentioned the Kinnick and the Pea River. I think you were telling me that you were getting into, or had heard rumors of, striped bass up in the Kinnick.
Yeah, so I have confirmed that the Kinnick for sure, the stripers that are down there like in the bay, coming from the Gulf of Mexico, will go all the way up to Point A Dam on the Kinnick when they're like doing their spawn and run, and also just trying to find refuge from those really warm water temps. When that water is coming out from the dams, a lot of times it's coming from down there at the bottom of the lake, so the water stays relatively cool. And during the summer months, they have to find somewhere to try to stay cool enough to make it to that next year. So the Kinnick is a little bit far from us over in Dothan, but I'm looking forward to getting a chance to try to drive over there to below Point A Dam and fishing that. I have a lot of experience fishing for stripe up on like the Tallapoosa River, but down here it's a lot different. The water conditions as far as like clarity and temperature are different. So I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to throw at them. Usually my go-to is like a real big swim bait, like 6-7 inch swim bait. Or if the water is calm, like not a lot of current, I'll throw a big spook and just work that like early in the morning. And a lot of times you can get those stripe they're a little more skittish, like even in smaller waterways early in the morning on a spook. So the Connect is one place I'm going to try. I've heard they're in the P as well. There used to be a dam up by Elba that they removed, but I think that dam removal caused like a big shoal-like feature that they probably hang out at. And then there's a lot of spring-fed creeks down just below the state line of Florida, like Holmes Creek. And I think they come out of the Chattahatchee into the spring-fed creek. So going to be a lot of exploring and just trying out different lures and places, but looking forward to trying to get into those stripers for sure. It's really cool because a lot of folks think about like the reservoir stripers in Alabama that are being stocked, but I believe these Gulf stripers that are coming up from the bay into these coastal rivers are actually like spawning naturally, and it's a more of a natural population. So for the folks that like to nerd out about the different species of fish and all that, it's definitely cool to see like native spawning stripers down in South Alabama.
Yeah, we have definitely been known to nerd out about fish species here on the podcast. We've had some folks on here to talk about some of the native sunfish. We've talked with Matt Lewis about the red-eye bass. We've talked with the Native Fish Coalition. We've talked with them, so we enjoy some native species. And yeah, when you get out there, I don't know where there is. I think River Falls is technically the closest town. That's where the Point A Dam is right there. But if you're coming from Dothan, you'll pass through Andalusia. Stop at Big Mike's Steakhouse when you get done fishing. And
okay, that's in Andalusia.
Yeah. Oh man. Okay. Big Mike's, come go hungry. Like stop after you get done fishing. Once you've had, I know me, if I've got a day out on the water, something about it gives me an appetite. They can fix your appetite problem there at Big Mike's Steakhouse. That's one of the best restaurants I've ever eaten at anywhere.
All right, man. I appreciate the hot tip on that one.
Absolutely. Yeah. Give me a holler when you go. That's not too far from my neck of the woods. We'll have to go out there and try it out together. I don't think I've ever fished the dam, but I've fished around there on the Sepulga and the Kaneka before, and they're definitely pretty little rivers tucked away. Don't see a lot of traffic.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Absolutely. Well, Taylor, I appreciate having you on the show. Keep me posted. I always enjoy seeing pictures of that dog in that canoe, and we'll holler at you later.
All right, man. Thanks again for having me on.
Absolutely. This week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report has been brought to you by Fish Bites. Whether you're hitting the sand with set rigs, using traditional scent strips for pompano, or fishing the flats and marshes for speckled trout, redfish, and flounder, Fish Bites has something for you. Family-owned and operated in St. Augustine, Florida, they pride themselves on making reliably consistent fishing products for anglers of all ages all around the world. Fish Bites baits and lures are made with pride in the Sunshine State here in USA. Check out the full line of scented saltwater and freshwater baits at fishbites.com. Alrighty, guys, we are back, and this time we are tuning in. We've got Adam Hudson. Adam is the CEO, co-owner of the Blue Line Company. If you're not familiar, they are an Alabama-based company up around Huntsville, and they sell flies. I was interested when I was perusing their website. I saw the Meemaw fly. So all you Alabama locals, I guess y'all know what all that's about. And I first found them, I was looking on YouTube doing some smallmouth fishing, doing some research, and saw some guys with some familiar-sounding accents who were just hammering the smallies. So extended an invite, and Adam was gracious enough to accept. Adam, I really appreciate it. I've been looking forward to this. This is the highlight of my week so far.
Well, absolutely. I guess your week has still plenty of time to keep going up there, doesn't it?
Man, I find that area up there on the Tennessee River to be super, super interesting. And smallmouth bass, I think that's the last Alabama black bass that I haven't caught. I've caught Choctaws, Alabamas, all the red eyes, and I'm itching to get up there, bother the local smallmouth population. So
Yeah. Well, you're doing pretty good then. Doing pretty good, except for the smallmouth. But, you know, like you said there, the Tennessee River's the southernmost extent range of the smallmouth native range. So if you're finding them south of there, which typically you really don't, but, you know, if you're finding them anywhere else, they're introduced or stocked. But, you know, we kind of ended up just lucked into growing up around Huntsville with the Tennessee River systems through there and Southern Tennessee, which is just, you know, some of the best smallmouth fishing around. So they just kind of caught my interest early and haven't let go of it.
Yeah. So, and there's not Alabama is not really, I think, top of mind when people think of a fly fishing state, although we've got a lot of miles of streamway. We've got a lot of diversity. You know, we just don't historically have trout, which for some reason is a handicap to us in the court of public opinion. But how did you end up starting a fly fishing company in Alabama?
Well, you know, like you alluded there, Stephen and I are both just from Huntsville. We got into fly fishing ourselves kind of separately. Ended up meeting each other when we were in middle school in Huntsville. And both of us were just love to fly fish and love to fish in general, and started fishing ever since then. And, you know, Huntsville has, as you said, just in the public eye, doesn't have a lot of fly fishing. And so it was, you know, not only hard to find people who were doing it, but it was just hard to find flies and in any sort of material, whether you were going to buy flies, tie your own. So it was always hard for me to find that stuff. So I started tying my own flies. Now my dad was a big conventional gear fisherman, and he would oftentimes go out on the lakes along the Tennessee River, and I wanted to go with him, but I wanted to learn how to fly fish, and it didn't make sense to me. No one was telling me that I couldn't catch bass on a fly rod. I just saw it as another way of fishing that I just thought was more fun than conventional fishing. So I started trying to tie my own flies to imitate whatever he was catching bass on, whether, you know, he was throwing swim baits or Cincos or, you know, chatter baits or whatever in the world he was throwing. I started tying my own flies just to try to imitate, or, you know, there were no fly shops where you could go in and get good information. So I would go into some of like the, you know, the gear and bait shops and ask those guys what kind of, you know, lures that they were throwing to try to imitate whatever, you know, the fishing reports were good at the time. So it's time kind of just progressed on. We started realizing even in the fly fishing world that there weren't very many companies offering flies that were specific for bass. Most of the flies that we found on the market were either just repurposed, maybe saltwater redfish patterns, or they were repurposed trout fishing patterns. And anyone who's listened to this knows that, you know, bass don't really act like either of those species. You need, you know, sometimes some specific hooks, specific sizes, colors, materials that are just going to target and trigger bass better than, you know, a trout fly would or a redfish fly might. So we just saw a big hole in the market for bass fishermen. And there's plenty of people out there who want to fly fish for bass. So we decided that, you know, there wasn't a company who was really, you know, standing behind that and giving guys who like to bass fish with fly rods the gear that they need to do that. So we decided to kind of just fill that hole in the market, and we've been going since then.
Yeah. I'm looking here at your website and I see you've got your bass flies. Of course you got trout flies, but then you've also got brown carp and redfish, which is all much more relevant to me down here in my neck of the world than salmon or steelhead flies or something like that. But musky flies. It's good to see. Good to see. I was looking the other day at y'all's Bramageddon bundle. Cause that's something I'm always interested in, is a couple of extra sunfish flies. I just, we had Ben Russo with the Gulf Coast FFI council a while back, and he was talking with us about their panfish slam. Man, a buddy just knocked that out. We got 8 different species, and I'm fast tracking my way to 12. We're racing to 12, see who gets bragging rights. So, I love it. I'm all for anything that gets, you know, more flies into the hands of warm water fly fishermen. So
yeah, man. And even, you know, even the brim stuff, you know, you don't find very many companies who are catering to guys who like to brim fish. And, you know, there's a ton of guys who just like to go out there, catch a ton of fish. I mean, you know, you don't have to worry too much about the bite or the conditions when brim fish, you know, they're typically, you know, you don't get skunk very often if you're out brim fishing, but you know, I understand that a lot of people love it. So we wanted to make sure that those guys were able to get good flies specifically developed to catch panfish and not trout.
There we go. Well, talk to me a little bit. I think in the past, I think Brian Sin has talked with some people who fish downstream of the dams up there and do the whole live bass, deep water, smallmouth thing. But what I'm interested in is fly fishing for them. And I don't know that we've ever discussed that on the show. We've had 200 and something episodes, and I don't know that we've talked about fly fishing for smallies. So kind of tell me about it, man. Like what, I know they're black bass. So I suspect that there's a lot of similarities with the other bass in the state, but how do they differ? What makes them unique?
Yeah, absolutely. So the big thing, you know, I think a lot of people imagine that, or I hear this quite a bit, is that smallmouth like colder water than largemouth do. And while that is true, that there's a little bit, an extra piece of science behind that, is that smallmouth typically, they prefer more oxygenated water than largemouth do. And cooler water can hold more oxygen in that water than really warm water will. So the cooler, they do prefer cool water, but there's a little bit more of a reason to that. It's because they prefer oxygenated water, and they like to sit in different kind of water throughout the year, just like largemouth, just like you know, a lot of different fish, like you were just talking about crappie to me a minute ago before we started. Same kind of thing. You know, they migrate in different water columns throughout the year. And smallmouth to do the same thing. But one of the reasons that we really enjoy fishing them is, you know, they'll almost winter over in the Tennessee River, especially the big ones will. It may even migrate all the way down into a big lake, reservoir, whatever. And in the summertime, they may run miles and miles and miles upriver in a you know, a feeder tributary to their main, the big water source where they may go hold over during winter. So I think typically they get a you know, a notion of, oh, smallmouth like cold water. When in turn, they're really, I think, kind of searching for that more oxygenated water. And this time of year, they really start pushing. And this time of year going into summer, they really start pushing upriver into really finding that oxygenated and cooler water that you might see, you know, in the tributaries coming into the lakes and rivers.
Well, that's definitely what I want to hear, because part of what I really enjoy about fly fishing is just it lends itself well to getting up into the tributaries and the tributaries of the tributaries. And a lot of the counties that I've fished, that's all that you have, you know, like there's a lot of big water that flows through Alabama, but there's a lot of counties, you know, particularly in the Wiregrass region and just some parts kind of, I guess, northeast central of the state. If you're not on the Tallapoosa or Coosa systems, you have, you know, miles and miles of stuff like the Hatchet Creek, stuff like that, where it's real easy to get in there with a fly rod. What are they usually like, just as far as what kind of lures they hit and stuff like that? Is it kind of the same as bass where you can tear them up with a, you know, some sort of topwater popper and a woolly bugger? Or are there any specialty flies that you guys like to throw at them?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, typically kind of transitioning from some of those deeper water holes to fish will start really pushing up and eating in those tributaries this time of year. And so we like to throw a lot of crawfish patterns. Certainly anyone listening to this who bass fishes is not surprised that bass love eating crawfish. So we've got some of the best crawfish patterns that specifically developed for bass fishing. And we love throwing crawfish this time of year. It's a great pattern. Can really get down to where the fish are sitting, whether they're on the bottom of the runs. We don't typically fish very much top water this time of year. That's a little more going into like late summer is when we typically find those fish will be really, really eager to eat top water early and late in the day. We really don't do a ton of top water fishing around North Alabama. And I'm not, certainly not saying you can't catch them, but unfortunately we don't find a lot of the really big fish are just not willing to eat on top. And typically when we're out, you know, just like the conventional guys are on the lakes, we're trying to catch the biggest fish that we can in the rivers. And So while you can typically put numbers on the board with poppers and our topwater foam flies, typically there's a pretty short window of the year that we found that that works really well. And this time of year is probably still a touch too early for it.
So this time of the year, and definitely what you were saying, even all the way down here on the coast, crawfish, crankbaits, those colored jig heads, like the fire crawl, delta crawl, all those colors that Strike King makes, and everybody has their own crawfish pattern. And yeah, that's definitely a staple down here. So you'd recommend you're just dragging this time of the year, dragging a crawfish imitation through the bottom.
Crawfish imitation on the bottom is hands down one of my favorites this time of year. And also typically early and late, especially if it's still cool. Just cool overnight, fishing them, you know, fishing low. Those fish don't really get fired up until it gets a little warmer. And smallmouth, just like a lot of bass, their metabolism runs based off of the temperature of the water. And the warmer that it gets, the more the kind of ramped up metabolism will get those fish a little more hungry. And throughout the day, especially if you start finding some nice, real nice weather days like we've been having, you know, with higher temps throughout the day, starting to get a lot of more sun on the water, really heating the water up, you start throwing some of the bait fish patterns. One of our just go-tos is any sort of big shad imitation. Like you already said, the Meemaw there is one of our favorites for this time of year. As the temps are rising, the water temps are starting to come up. Of course, the water temps run a little behind the ambient air temperatures, as we all know. So the water temperatures are finally starting to really get on the rise with the rising temperatures here. And throughout the middle of the day, really, really are keying in on some of those bigger bait fish patterns.
That definitely sounds good. Crawfish and shiners is a language that I can speak.
Yep.
Where are they relating? So I found with different bass, they relate differently to current, like largemouth, and in general terms, you know, it changes in different waterways, different times of the year. But largemouth, you know, if there's current, my experience is they don't want to be in it too terribly much. Spotted bass, they'll get in it or be current adjacent. And then red eye bass, it seems like they'll be right in the middle of it. Or smallmouth, the type, do they hold in the current, just out of the current, and the frog water off to the sides? What's that usually look like?
Yeah, so in the winter, fall through right around now, they typically will not hold in the current. They'll hold kind of adjacent, or maybe even find them in that largemouth water, in more of the lakey stretches of the rivers, or the bigger rivers like the Tennessee, and sitting pretty deep throughout fall through spring. This time of year, they're really starting to push up into that current. And yet again, not exactly, I'm not saying that every fish is obviously a little bit different. And in no way am I the world leading expert on smallmouth biology, but moving water will allow smallmouth two things. Number one, moving water is going to have more oxygen in it than stagnant water. So they do like to have that kind of oxygenated flowing water. But on the flip side, they also are ambush predators, just like largemouth are, but smallmouth really like to be pretty lazy. They'll like to sit behind a log, behind a rock, behind some structure on the bottom or on the side of the river and wait for that crawfish to kind of come down through the current, or to wait for that wounded bait fish or that shiner to make a mistake and just be kind of floating down through some current, where they'll jump out and grab them. So we're still kind of transitioning right now from being in some deeper water and the tail outs of holes are right in the middle of some of that deeper water in the rivers, pushing up into the more shallow runs where they'll sit, where a lot of the fish will sit through the summer. That doesn't mean that you should miss some of the bigger, deeper holes. And certainly the smallmouth will still hang out through there. And they typically will cycle in and out of those from feeding lanes where they're up in the current feeding, looking for something to eat, where they may slide out of that into those deeper holes to be sitting as just a much safer spot away from the raccoons or all the eagles and predators that we have around Alabama. Those fish will kind of slide in and out of those spots depending upon time of day and if they're hungry or not.
I got you. Is smallmouth, in your opinion, right now, is that something that you pursue all year? Is that something that's particularly hot this time of the year? Or what else do y'all have going on right now in the Tennessee River that's a good bite?
The gar are coming off a spawn, can are starting to come off a spawn, and gar fishing is a ton of fun up here. During spawn, they're dang near impossible to catch with a fly, but this time of year, the gar fishing is awesome. Carp is kind of pretty similar with the gar. They spawn in the spring. If the carp are coming off of the spawn, they're incredibly hungry. They're about the easiest that they can be to catch all year this time of year coming off a spawn. The carp can be incredibly fun to catch as well. Certainly the largemouth and the spotted bass bite is also great this time of year. So we've got a ton of stuff that you can fish for, but the smallmouth this time of year is really starting to heat up. Mid-May is when they'll really start getting it. They're starting right now to really get into their summer feeding lanes, which is that shallower water, the really up close to structure with moving water and current. That's just the most fun spot to catch them because you get to watch those fish come out and eat. And that's when this is the time that we really like to start smallmouth fishing.
What about up there? I've caught south. I've caught rock bass, and I know rock bass on the Tennessee River system. That's actually a shadow bass, or no? I'm getting that mixed up. It's shadow bass if you're outside the Tennessee system. Do y'all get into good numbers of rock bass up there?
Oh yeah. There's a lot of times we'll be floating, especially if I'm guiding some guys who are new to fly fishing, teaching them to fish for bass. What the rock bass can save the day. Typically this time of year we tend to find them pretty schooled up still, and it's a lot of fun. A lot of times if you catch one, you may sit there on that same hole and catch five or six more of them. And they're a ton of fun on a fly. They eat really well, but they typically will eat a little bit smaller flies than what some of the smallmouth will eat. Like that Meemaw is maybe a little too big for those rock bass. So if you size those things down a little bit, they're a really, really fun species to target with a fly.
I'm definitely hoping to get into one of them because that would be a species towards my FFI Suncatch Slam. So I got to get one of those knocked off the list. And it's funny you
Yeah,
mentioned gar.
they're a bunch of fun.
I was up in a little sandy creek here the other day, and it wasn't much more than ankle deep, but there was about a 4 foot spotted gar. Looked like he was moving in there trying to get up into some spawning ground. So the red horse suckers, that ended a long time ago. That seems to be the first fish we have spawned down here. You're talking about carp. Do y'all have buffalo there on the Tennessee?
Yep, absolutely. We've got common carp, mirror. So every once in a while, you might hear someone catching mirror carp. Have a lot of lake carp or grass carp, some call them. There's Gunnersville is very well known for grass carp. The past couple of world record grass carp have come out of Gunnersville, so we've seen a lot of those. So we've got a few of all the bottom feeding fish around to catch.
Yeah, I know it's a super. The Tennessee River is a super, super diverse waterways, and I always enjoy getting up that way. Adam, I really appreciate all your time. I appreciate you letting me pick your brain on smallmouth for a little bit. Hope to have you back on the show. But until then, if folks want to learn more about smallmouth and check out some of your flies, where's a good place to check you out at?
Yeah, you can watch some of our films on YouTube, which have some cool bass fishing films, and also some other just good fly fishing films and tips and tricks. You can find us on YouTube at just Blue Line Co. Or of course, you can head on over to our website at bluelineflies.com, and that'll show you all our bass flies. You can filter by species, whether it's carp, gar, bass, trout, whatever you're trying to do, panfish. And you can find your flies there.
There we go, guys. Y'all definitely go check them out. Support an Alabama company. And Adam, I appreciate having you on the show.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me. Thanks so much for inviting me on.
This week's episode has been brought to you by Southeastern Pond Management. Since 1989, Southeastern Pond Management has been a leader in pond and lake management services. If you own a pond or lake anywhere in the Southeast, Southeastern Pond Management can evaluate the health of your pond and then work with you individually to put together the right plan to get what you want out of your body of water. Through electrofishing, liming, fertilizing, and stocking and weed control, Southeastern Pond Management is the one-stop shop to help you produce more healthy trophy fish than ever before. Schedule an obligation-free consultation today. Call 1-888-830-POND or email info@southeastpond.com. Alrighty, guys, last but definitely not least, we've got Jason Throneberry with the Nature Conservancy. I've been keeping up off and on with some of the projects Jason's been involved in Alabama over the past couple years, and I'm excited to be able to sit down and talk with him in person. Jason, what's going on, man?
Oh, just another day, Nick. How you doing?
Man, I'm sitting here. We are doing some very belated spring cleaning, and it's way too hot to be doing it, but I'm sitting here filling up a 10-yard dumpster with the stuff that you accumulate. I was telling my wife the other day, I used to give my dad a hard time because we'd have a 2-car garage that you couldn't park cars in, and now I've turned into my dad. I'm sitting here with a 1,000-square-foot house that's got 2,000-square-foot worth of stuff in it. So
I can relate to every bit of that.
well, man, I feel like you don't need much of an introduction, but for those listening in, Jason is the Freshwater Programs Director with the Nature Conservancy in Alabama. He does a lot of really good stuff with stream restoration. He does some important work with our fisheries, particularly. He's got a project going on right now talking about getting some fish passages around some dams, trying to restore some migratory routes for fish like sturgeon and Gulf Stream striped bass. TNC does a lot of work. I hunt a lot of property that was originally purchased by the Conservancy. And I guess, first of all, Jason, what led, kind of walk me through what led from you being, you know, just a sportsman to working in conservation?
Sure. Well, I know, you know, a lot of us people in this realm of work did start out hunting and fishing in the wilds of our state. So, you know, I grew up in South Arkansas, a lot of pretty iconic places, the White River National Refuge, the Cache River, Big Woods, Mississippi River, Arkansas River. So pretty big landscape to cut your teeth in. And, you know, each time I'd go out, as I started getting older, I just noticed that every time I went out, something was different. Maybe it was a different season. Maybe the water level was a little different. What was going on with the plants and the animal life was a little different. So getting to be out there in it and seeing all those minute changes and, you know, knowing when the crappie are going to bite, knowing when the bass are spawning, knowing when the bluegill are bedding up, knowing when the ducks are going to come in. That was all a big part of it. And then you start putting two and two together. You're like, wow, I mean, this is all connected. Everything depends on everything. If something goes wrong or fails, it's going to affect something else. So that's kind of what got me really interested, is seeing interconnectivity, not of just the sport species, but, you know, your species that are supposed to be there. Like I said, the plant life, the wildlife, all of that, just, and, you know, how it's all depends on each other and how it changes from time to time. So that's kind of what led to me pursuing a, first of all, degrees in, you know, fisheries biology, and then a master's in just basically straight biology, but focusing on rare species ecology. So there's a lot of species out there that a lot of people don't know anything about, and being able to see, touch, know those things is just, that's what kind of really got me into what I'm doing now. And then realizing, of course, that it's not just about a single species. You have to make the whole ecosystem resilient and better to support all these facets of wildlife and plants, to make sure that these systems are not only healthy, but can remain that way with all the crazy changes we got going on.
Well, talking about where you are now in your career, Jason, what is your role with TNC? What's your day-to-day look like?
Oh, well, day-to-day is very different depending on the day and what's going on. So, you know, the freshwater program has basically three legs that we kind of stand on. One being, you know, aquatic connectivity, so fish passage. One being kind of the rural stream bank restoration, working with the private landowners, working with the farmers to ensure the health of these rivers. And then thirdly, we do have an urban aspect. So a lot of our most important headwater streams in the whole state are right here in the Birmingham metro area. So not a very friendly place for a small, you know, for a small tributary of a large river that that ultimately ends up in the Gulf. So we do that as well. So a normal day, I could be out on, you know, Farmer Joe and Jane's property, looking at stream bank restoration potential, trying to push farm bill programs. You know, I could actually be on a track hoe. I could be driving a dump truck. I could be in a boat on the Lower Alabama River, you know, giving a tour to trustees, reporters, just general outreach. I could be beating the bushes trying to find some of these big farmers that we could really benefit from doing conservation practices on their land. I may be in Washington, D.C. talking to senator and representative staff, trying to make sure our agenda, first of all, that they know Alabama is the most important place for freshwater work in the whole universe. And then secondly, that we need money to do that. So we need to find a way for federal funds, state funds, you know, so on and so forth, private funds to be really focused where they can do the most good. So we kind of run the gamut, man. It really just depends on the day and the time. And of course, I'm always writing grants. You know, we are a nonprofit. We are expected to write these large public and private grants. So federal dollars, state dollars, private dollars. We've always got our hand in the cookie jar trying to get our share for conservation. So,
well, there's definitely y'all do a lot of work. And I know that's something that I, as a sportsman, have directly benefited from, with the properties around here that I hunt, boat, recreate on. And then, you know, something like you were talking about, like the headwaters up there in Birmingham with the Cahaba River, I've actually fished there, done some fly fishing up that way. And, I'm actually, my listeners are probably tired of me talking about it, but I'm almost done fly fishing every county in Alabama. And I live here. I've lived most of my life on, you know, Mobile Bay down here in Baldwin County. And right now I'm sitting on my house on the Tensaw River Delta, looking out at the water. And something that's just struck me as I have fished all these counties is, you know, like I was fishing up in Jefferson County one day, fishing a little tributary of the Cahaba up there. And it just struck me, like, all this water is going the same place I'm going when I get done. Like, I'm going back home to the Delta, and all this water, this clean, clear water, is going to that Delta. And along the way, it's picking up sediment, nutrients, fish poo, and whatever else is along the way, you know, PCBs, mercury, arsenic, everything, you know, everything that's from Birmingham to Mobile is eventually going to end up in my backyard. So that's it's crazy to me how connected everything is. Here I'm at the terminus of everything. Like, it all chokes down to a 7 mile wide swamp. The Cahaba, the Coosa, the Tallapoosa, everything comes through here. And I'm particularly interested in learning more about it. I feel like I'm late to the game. This is just something I started hearing about in the past few months, but there's been a lot of talk about the dams. There's been people throw around dam removal. There's been people talking about the bypass channels. I've been learning more about Gulf strain, native Gulf strain striped bass, as opposed to like the Tennessee stocker fish. What can you tell me? Where is that project looking at? Tell me some about the bypass channels y'all are working to put in.
Sure. So in November of 2021, we started the feasibility study with the Corps of Engineers for fish passage at Claiborne and Miller's Ferry locks and dams. So just for a little geographical context, those are the bottom two dams on the Alabama River system. So Claiborne being the southernmost, and then Miller's Ferry being another one. So two very different dams. You know, Claiborne, has an associated spillway with it. So there's always, you know, usually, I say always, there's usually water running over that spillway, and that dam goes underwater. Like, I was out there earlier this late winter, early spring, and you didn't know there was a dam there except for the pump house. Except for the control house sticking out. So that dam's made to go underwater. It's not flood control. It does not have it. You know, it does have a lock associated with it. But then you move up to Miller's Ferry. This is a run of the river dam all the way across. No water gets through unless they're letting it through. It has an associated lock with it as well. And then, of course, it has the Miller's Ferry powerhouse. So there's a hydroelectric component. So two very different systems. And we've known that, of course, we haven't had fish passage in that area from basically the Gulf up to Miller's Ferry since the dams were built, back in the late 60s, early 70s. So you know, a lot of people before me have known that this is a problem, was going to turn into a problem. And this is just kind of the end of all that. Like, okay, we got to quit talking about it. The time is right. We're fixing to start seeing big time species implications. Species just aren't going to be here anymore. This resource will never be like it could be, should be, and was at, you know, historically. So now's the time. So we agreed to basically sign on as the non-federal sponsor for the feasibility study. So you have to have a feasibility study in order to get a project started. So that's, this is a net, this is a step that the Corps of Engineers has to take to even get considered for congressional budget allocation for implementation. So first of all, you have to go through this big study. You have to, you know, this, this is a very short version of it, but you have to identify the ecological benefits, the economical benefits or deficits, the benefits to people, the potential for any threats to existing infrastructure, to existing activities. So all that has to be taken into consideration. So long story short, we, you know, we've been going down that road for about 2.5 years. The study will be completed and signed off by the Army Corps of Engineers no later than November of 2024. So that's right at 3 years. And that's, I mean, there's a lot that went into that process. We're kind of in the, you know, the last throes of it right now. Yeah. So that's, and I'll just, that was a lot. So I'll just let you ask more questions if you want to dig deeper.
Yeah, no, it's, and I really am. I'm learning about this. I mean, I've read some little snippets here and there, but sometimes I know stuff like this, it stretches along over such a long period of time and so many different people report on little snippets of it and it's hard to get the whole picture. So I'm excited to be talking with somebody who's kind of at the heart of it all. So I guess like doing the feasibility study, like, was there work done to talk about, like, which species were currently being impacted by the dams that were in place?
Yes, there was. So, you know, you have species that, that are migratory, and that may be all the way from the Gulf up to the Cahaba River. That may just be from point A to point B within the river. So you have different kinds of migratory species. And then you have species that just like to move up in the tributaries to spawn or do their thing. And they need those, you know, that access to that. So We were doing the you know, kind of the ecological analysis of all the alternatives. So we started out with like 26 alternatives on the table for what this could look like. And that was ranging from dam removal to do nothing, business as usual. So everything you can imagine in between there, what was looked at through a lens. So we put together a list of basically 19 different species, all of which are migratory in some facet, whether that being from the Gulf all the way up somewhere or just locally migrant within the river during different periods of time. So we looked at not only those 19 species, we made sure those species fit within, were representative of all three types of fishes, if you will, guilds. We call them guilds of fish. So one being pelagic, which like the big open river, they're in the water column, they're just swimming around. You have your benthic species that are going to be your bottom dwellers, like your sturgeon, your darters, stuff like that. And then you're going to have your littoral species, which would be the species that use your river margins. They like a lot of vegetation. They may like more rock. So we made sure not only that we were looking at migratory species, but we're taking into account all the different kinds or all the different places within that river system that they need to move. And then furthermore, a lot of these fishes are host species for freshwater mussels. So we also picked some of the migratory fish that would be host species for some of our most endemic and threatened mussel species as well. And that's both in the all the tributaries to the Alabama River up to the Cahaba, and then, of course, the main stem as well. So we tried to be as all, you know, all inclusive as possible when it came to the different fishes.
Well, so 19 species, and I don't want to put you on the spot. I don't know if you're sitting at a list of those species, but I know I've heard sturgeon talked about. I've heard Gulf strain striped bass talked about. And then Alabama shad, I think, was one of them that got brought up, right?
Yeah, several. And like I said, paddlefish are in there. Paddlefish are locally migrant. American eels, that, you know, they spend some of their life in the ocean. They spend some of their life in freshwater. And then we're talking about stuff like mobile log perch, which is a little, you know, a darter that does move up and down the system and uses very specific species. I mean, uses very specific habitats, you know, for its needs. So, and like you said, I do not have the huge list in front of me, but it runs the gamut from fish an inch long all the way up to, you know, the biggest sturgeon you can imagine. So,
yeah, sturgeon are big and paddlefish get big. I've caught some of them down here on the Delta. And then American eels, the first, I remember the first American eel I ever caught and going into the deep dive on what in the world is this thing? And don't they spawn like most fish come up in the river to spawn? They spawn in salt and come up in the river. And don't they spawn somewhere over in like the Mediterranean or something? Or am I making that up?
They have a crazy life cycle. So there's the glass eel phase. There's the phase when it's in the river. There's the phase. Yeah, I'm not up on my eel ecology, and not as much as I should be. But yes, they have a very unique life plan and life history requirements for sure.
Well, going back, so talking about those species, those are all cool species, and I definitely I think there's a lot of people who want to see those species protected. I know some of them are game fish, some of them aren't. You know, I know striped bass, that's a huge sport fish in particular. But so as y'all have kind of moved through this and been doing this feasibility study, I guess a twofold question is one, where are y'all at right now? Is that looking like the most likely solution is to do the bypass channels around the dam?
Yeah, so that was decided back in May of 2023. So that is when that was the milestone, if you will, for the what they call the preferred alternative. So the Corps, TNC, our federal, state, and private, our, you know, partners went through all this. We looked at the ecological analysis, looked at the cost analysis, looked at the ecological and the economic benefits. That was all taken into consideration. At the end of the day, the Corps said our number one choice for fish passage at these structures is natural bypass channels at each dam. And there was two competing alternatives. One was a fixed weir rock arch, which if anybody's interested in that, you can Google fixed weir rock arch and you'll probably get the Cape Fear River in North Carolina. That's our southeastern version of a fixed weir rock arch, which has been successful for certain species. But with the natural bypass channel, we were able to make sure that we're not, like I said, this is for all species that could possibly use it. So the slope of the channel, the velocity of water coming through this thing, that all has to be looked at. And it was all taken into consideration when we got our kind of I don't want to say designs, nothing's designed yet. No engineer has designed a plan, but we have a rough sketch of what this thing is going to look like, how big it's going to be, what the slope's going to be, how long it has to be to achieve that slope. What do the velocities look like when we're running water through it? Are these fish going to be able to get up it? So all that's been taken into consideration after the fact. So yes, that choice has been made. We are, you know, not done. I don't want to say done. We're never done with something, but now the ball's in the Corps of Engineers court, they're putting together their final chief's report. And that's, you know, that's all within the Corps themselves. So this has to go through three tiers of Corps engineers. It has to go from the Mobile district level up to the South Atlantic Division and then on up to headquarters. So it has to pass through three different chains of command to get a final. So this is the Mobile district's time to write the final report, you know, get everything in there, get their cost projections in there and send it up the chain. So we're just kind of sitting in limbo waiting for the final signature in November.
Is this, once you get that signature, moving forward with it, is it something where people are going to see work on those passages in 1 year, 10 years? Is there a rough time frame or has there been a time frame? This ties into a question that I meant to ask, like, have fish passages been put in around dams in other states and that had a positive impact on the fisheries? And can we kind of look at other states and see how long it took them to move through that process?
Well, nobody in the Southeast has really ever done a natural bypass channel, at least not at this huge scale on a major river around a huge, you know, lock and dam structure. So the short answer is no, we don't know. But there are many enabling conditions that have to happen. First of all, this project has to get into the Water Resources Development Act through Congress, through the Senate. And that is what puts this project in queue to get congressional budget allocation. So the Corps will have their money to move forward with implementation. So not only is there federal money involved, then we have to, you know, there is a, likely a non-federal portion that has to be done as well. And so that's the first enabling condition. And then we have to, of course, work with the Corps of Engineers to get the final engineering done and all the permits. And that's a whole process. That's a lot of legwork. A lot goes into that, both, logistically and just getting stuff done wise. So I don't really want to put a number on it because we don't know. But hopefully, hopefully it's done sooner than later, I guess, is all I can say.
For sure. Well, it's definitely something I've enjoyed reading up on and learning more about. Like, I really want to have a guy on to talk some point about the differences between, like, Gulf Stream striped bass and stalker bass. Like, that's native fish have really become a big interest of mine here in the past year. And so this would connect, because I know there's been some dam removal on the Cahaba River over the years, dams that were no longer in use. This, if you would need to bypass Claiborne and Miller's Ferry, and then that would connect the Gulf to the Cahaba all the way up to Birmingham. Am I reading that right, or is there other stops along the way?
Yeah, I mean, so the last barriers on the Cahaba, starting from the top here, going down, there's the 280 Dam, which of course is our water intake for drinking water here in Birmingham. That's pumped into Lake Purdy and all that good stuff. And then you have basically three or four mill dams just right below that. And then the rest of the Cahaba River is wide open, buddy, all the way down to the mouth. And then if we can get bypass around these two dams, so you got roughly 150 miles of the Cahaba and then roughly 170 miles of Alabama River that are connected, ecologically connected. There's water flowing into and out of each other right now. People could argue, well, they're connected. They're not ecologically connected. Not when they need to be, at least. So,
sure. Well, it's an exciting project, and I feel like I'm just scratching the surface on it. But for time constraints, I do want to talk about some other stuff. And I'm with this job, sometimes I can't stand it. I have to be selfish, and I get to talk about things that are immediately interesting to me. And I bought this property because it was on 90,000 acres of publicly accessible land, and some of that I've watched it over the course of my life get added to. And I was very interested when I heard the news a couple months back that the quote unquote land between the rivers up there in Clark County, between the Alabama and the Tom Bigby, had been picked up. Mm-hmm. How do y'all decide? Cause like, I know y'all've got property here at Splinter Hill by my house, and some of that is open to hunters. There's some property up in Monroe County that I've had a lot of fun hog hunting over the past 10 years that I shouldn't talk about on air. y'all pick up a lot of properties. I guess what made y'all look at that 8,000 acres and think, yeah, that needs to be protected?
Well, first of all, there's a reason that, that we acquire land, and that's through TNC identification of important places, important ecosystems, important plants, important animals, all that stuff, but also working with our partners to identify, hey, where are the special places? Like, we know some, but everybody knows something. So we have to put our heads together. So, they've known about this area. I mean, this is the land between the rivers. That's the tip top of the upper Delta, the upper Mobile Delta. So it's the capstone of the Delta, and it's the keystone. I mean, it's kind of like the gateway into that migratory corridor from the Gulf all the way up into the Appalachians, and then ultimately all the way to Maine as a migratory corridor, both terrestrial and water driven. This isn't just about water. You can't just look at water and say, oh, that's a river, it ain't connected to nothing. It's about the forest matrix, the ecosystems, the animals, that whole corridor, whether it's water, land, air, whatever it is. So that's all one big piece. So this is a very strategic place. And then secondly, this, we knew it was, of course, I mean, this is the Shangri-La. I mean, if you're an outdoorsman, this is just the most beautiful and opportunity rich place in a lot of places, so we've known about it, but it was also under imminent threat. So if we would not have stepped in and able to put together a land deal and acquire this property, it would not have been kept in conservation. we won't go into what it could have become, but, you know, it would have been sold to a lot less conservation-minded entities and would never be the same after that. And we had a chance to do something. So that's the reason that we picked it, but just because it has so many different things. Like I said, it's the tip top of the Delta. It's the very bottom of that migratory corridor all the way up the Appalachian Mountains. So
it is definitely a special place. And my wife and I, when we bought this house 6 years ago, we looked at places on some other WMAs, and especially for southwestern Alabama, it is hard to beat the Mobile Tensaw Delta if you're a sportsman. And particularly, I'm really happy that land got picked up, because there's a, you know, the Delta, anybody down here who's been on it knows, like, you change from, you know, phragmites and kind of like salt marsh down south, and then you hit the tree line and you get into your cypress trees and your tupelos, and then up where I'm at is where you first start getting into your hardwoods. You'll start seeing higher ground and oaks. And then You get a few miles up from me, and like that area right there is a lot of hardwood timber. And man, like, again, I shouldn't talk about it on air, but when it comes to growing big deer for this region, we don't have deer like they do on the Black Belt or in Tennessee River, but every year they pull deer out of that swamp. I've pulled a couple that were nice deer. Last year, there was a guy here locally shot a deer that was huge. I mean, made the local news. And the ducks are unreal. When those oak trees start dropping and then they flood and they get that 6 inches to a foot of water, dude, you go out there and there's more ducks than trees, it looks like.
Now you're speaking my language. Place. I mean, of course, like I said, I grew up in Arkansas, so waterfowl's in my blood. And yeah, that's one of the few places I can go in Alabama and feel even close to, you know, what it is to hunt the big woods with all the oaks and stuff. So yeah, it's a very special place, if nothing else, for just that, for me.
Oh yeah. Yeah, man. It that is one of my favorite things to do is take my dog out there and be standing in some flooded timber and have them first few wood ducks start coming over, and you start hear shots popping in the distance off on the main river, and you tighten your grip and you're like, all right, here they come. Like,
yep. Can't beat it.
Coming to this hole in the woods. Well, man, that is awesome. So what is the plan, or is there a plan yet? I know it just got acquired. Is that going to be something that the Nature Conservancy holds on to? Is it going to be something that potentially Forever Wild is interested in picking up? Like, is what's the status of it now? Like, if somebody goes up there, is that something that they can walk? Is that something that in a few years may be hunting? Or is that something that's just going to be set aside to kind of protect that ecosystem there?
Well, that's all yet to be determined. Right now, we do own it outright. It is not open to the public right now. But the plan in the future, I don't know what that time frame is. That's not really my call here. But it will be, I mean, the final outcome will be this land will be public land in whatever facet that may take. I mean, that could take on many faces, but that's the overall scheme. We bought it because it was being imminently threatened. We were able to muster up the money, and hopefully it will. I mean, you know, of course it's going to be in conservation in perpetuity now that we own it. At the very least, it'll have restrictions on to it when we sell it or give it to whomever. But in the end, it will be our end game is to have it be public land. But there's no timeline, or we have discussed some things, but there's not really a plan forward right now.
Sure. And I totally understand, you know, with it being new, and then I understand that there's always considerations that you guys and the Bureau of Land Management and the Department of, you know, Parks, like Fish and Wildlife, everybody has to make the decision how much pressure can a place take, like how much human intrusion is good for the ecosystem. We've got some really fragile stuff here on the coast, pitcher plant bogs and stuff like that. So, but it's just encouraging to know that that stuff is going to exist. And then, yeah, I've pulled a lot of deer and haven't got a turkey yet. The turkeys over there at that Splinter Hill property will give you fits. But I've had a lot of good mornings as a sportsman on some property that was originally TNC property. So it's definitely a good thing going on. Well, man, we've talked about the bypass channels. I think that's interesting. That big chunk up there in Clark County is interesting. But what other projects do y'all have cooking right now in Alabama?
Well, specific to the freshwater world, I mean, we do 3 to 4 to 5 large scale, you know, stream bank restorations, habitat restorations a year, most of those being on private agriculture producer lands. And those are in very specific watersheds that are kind of our focal watersheds. Like I said, we do urban stormwater, we do urban stormwater policy, all kinds of stuff. And then outside of, you know, outside of the freshwater world, of course, we have our protection, which is that's how we buy land. That, you know, that's our, you know, director of protection and everybody. So we're always looking for these special pieces of land that we could get and then pass along or put deed restrictions on or whatever, and then keep them as wild places. Then we have, of course, we have one of the most active and awesome prescribed fire groups, in the Southeast, in my mind. You know, we're definitely leading the charge for more prescribed fire and better prescribed fire management within the state of Alabama. And that's what, you know, kind of TNC has always hung their hat on. Big, you know, good fire is a big deal. So they really do that well. I was a fire manager in my young days with TNC back in the early 2000s. So that's kind of how I got into the TNC world, was being a prescribed fire technician. So we do that still. We do it well. Trying to think of anything else. Of course, we have, you know, fundraisers who help us. We are a nonprofit, so help us raise money both on the private front, the public front, with your federal, state dollars. I'm trying to think of anything else. But we've got our, like I said, we have got our hands in everything, sir.
Well, I definitely, anybody who is late to the curve, behind on the times on fire management, you can go to the property over on Splinter Hill, and I would agree. I walk that regularly, at least once a week. I go out there to walk, and man, y'all burned it earlier this year. I forget when exactly, but right as spring was starting up, I was out there, and it was still smoking in places. And then to watch over the course of a spring, just, it was astonishing. Like the number of plants that came back, the turkeys that were on that property, the deer that were on that property, the number of migratory bird species that were up there in those longleaf pines. Like it was surreal how that place bounced after a burn, and y'all are always burning it. I would agree. Y'all do a really good fire management program, particularly on the pieces that y'all control. Yeah. I mean, y'all do a lot for conservation in Alabama, and I always like talking with guys who get into conservation, you know, from the standpoint of somebody who grew up with a fishing rod in their hand or a gun in their hands. That is something, as I've gotten older, I haven't gotten involved in it professionally so much, but just, I think it's part of the life cycle of an outdoorsman, right? Is you go out there and you see the stuff and you have the fun, and then you realize like, hey, this isn't something you should take for granted. Like this doesn't have to always be this way. Like we could lose it. So you need to take steps to make sure that you can continue to enjoy it and that you can pass it on to people. That becomes more important to me every year. As much as I like to shoot a duck or catch a fish, it's getting more fun to put somebody else on it who's never done it before.
Yeah.
So we want to support conservation here on this show. And as much as you see on your end, like you've kind of got the big picture view of all these projects going on in Alabama, and you know where help is needed and what can be done. Do you have any advice or any direction that you can give to people who are listening in who want to support the conservation efforts that y'all are doing, or any of your partners, particularly as that contributes to the freshwater side of things?
Sure. First of all, I mean, you know, as the resource users, hunters, fishermen, conservationists, hikers, canoers, boaters, whatever, we all have a big voice. So first of all, speak up for your water resources. If you think something's going on that ain't supposed to be going on, say something. But, you know, we need to really celebrate. We need to really get behind the rivers, the streams, the wildlands, the forest of Alabama, and really celebrate the importance of those resources. Because I think everybody agrees, whether you're using it to harvest a, you know, the deer of a lifetime, shoot a duck, catch a fish, or you want to buy it and see it in preservation and not another person sets foot on it, those same goals are there. You know, those same loves for this land, for these waters are there. So that goes a long way. So make sure and speak up for those resources anytime you can. And, you know, spread the word. You know, take somebody fishing, and when you're fishing, tell them about, like, hey, well, this is happening. Do you know why these fish are here, or how they got here, and how this connects to everything else? Awareness goes a long way. A lot of people just don't look at it. I mean, I am forced to in my life now, of course, because I've been a conservationist for years. That's just how I look at things. I look at the connected, you know, in all the puzzle pieces fitting together from a very, you know, a big high 20,000 foot view. So, you know, try to step back and look at it from that, like this affects that, this affects that. But first and foremost, speak up for your resources and, you know, try to raise awareness and, you know, try to preach a little love for the outdoors and what all that entails.
Absolutely. Well, Jason, really enjoyed having you on. Hope to have you on again in the future. Maybe we can get some updates on the different projects that y'all are doing.
Sure, that'd be great. Next time we'll still do it at duck blind though.
Hey, man, you have a standing invite to come down here. I got a duck dog, old Amos Moses.
Old Amos.
Old Amos now. He can fetch a duck. He's not good for much else other than he'll leave a warm spot on the couch for you.
But I hear you. Well, thanks for having me, Nick.
Fetch a duck. Absolutely. Yes, sir. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, man. Just give me a call if anything else.
This week's episode has been brought to you by Killer Doc. Most fishermen clean their fish on something like an unsightly old wooden table or the top of a cooler, somewhere that's not comfortable, not sanitary, and not attractive. Killer Doc makes the greatest fish cleaning stations known to mankind. They are built from marine-grade aluminum and ceramic-coated to protect them from the harsh salt environment. Killer Doc makes tables and canopies at several different sizes, so whatever you need on your dock, deck, or patio, they have a fish cleaning station for you. Check out killerdoc.com to see more. All right, folks, that's going to wrap it up for this week. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And again, don't forget to text that code ALFFR to 779-345-2918. Again, just text ALFFR, it's Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report, to 779-345-2918. Subscribe to our email list and we'll send you the promo code via email. This week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report has been brought to you by Texas Hunter. Since 1954, Texas Hunter Products has delivered the finest quality fish and game feeders and hunting blinds in the industry. To learn more, visit texashunter.com. Also by Hilton's Real-Time Navigator, bringing you the highest quality online satellite fishing charts since 2004. Your source for sea temps, allometry, currents, and water color at hiltonsoffshore.com. Also brought to you by Dixie Supply and Baker Metalworks manufacture a variety of metal roofing systems to meet your needs. Whether you're putting a new roof on your home or sheeting a commercial building, they have you covered. Dixie Supply and Baker Metalworks, your metal roofing headquarters.